Session number 11487, Eric Jones, reel 2 of 6.
Eric Jones, reel 2.
Do I accept that members of the Friends Amlan unit should get exemption?
Could I ask you now about this camp? You know, first of all, the other point there. Did the Quakers form a very large proportion of the members in your camp, would you say?
No. This is what surprised me, that I've never really worked it out, but I don't think at any time were the Quakers in the majority. I think there were quite a lot of Congregationalists in my camp. There were quite a number of them. There was quite a lot of Methodists. There weren't many Anglicans. There were a few, but not many. And then there were the... You mentioned talking to me earlier about Tom Barnsley. I don't know what Tom told you, but he was very much a political character. He was a socialist, and Tom was an accountant, I think, or he was studying for accountancy at the time. But I always remember the story he told us of his political activity in the West Midlands, of being standing up at the corner of the street somewhere, him and one other chap, trying to hold a meeting against an anti-war meeting, and ending up being chased down the street by a lot of women who were after his blood. But there were one or two of Tom's sort of thinking, mainly politically, against the war. But the majority of people were Christians of some church, aren't they?
Was it good to be with, you know, like-minded people?
Yes, it was very good. We used to go for route marches round up the Bristol Road from the camp. The camp was on the Bristol Road in Birmingham, and go up towards the Lickey Hills. And there was not much antagonism there, because too many people were employed by Cadbury's, of course, you see. But they used to call the Cadbury's chocolate soldiers. They were generally very kind to us, really. I don't remember anybody being at all antagonistic in that part of Birmingham. But it was a good camp. It was great to be with similar thinking people. In fact, you know, when I joined, like, when I registered at home and found that I was the second, and I doubt that there would be many after me until the end of the war, actually. But we were with 40 chaps who thought very much alike. Actually, the interesting thing was, I remember getting on a tram in Birmingham, the centre of Birmingham, to go down on the Bristol Road. These trams were still running then. And there was one other fellow who was obviously going to the camp. I got talking to him, and he had just come out of the army. He was a lieutenant in the army, and had... realised that he couldn't go ahead with it, and he'd gone to a tribunal, and he'd been exempted from army service.
What was his name?
I can't remember his name. If I think of it, I'll tell you. It might be worth... if I don't know where he is or what he's doing, but I'll let you know somewhere or another. He might be well worth interviewing. It would be one... It was the only one I ever knew. We had a number go the other way. I worked for a dentist in Shropshire whose brother had been in the Friends Amlan unit, and then he joined the Air Force. He'd been killed, his plane had been shot down. And there was another chap who was with me in camp, who was married with, I think, 3 children, much older than the rest of us, and he just couldn't afford to stay on in the FAU, so he joined... He still was a pacifist, but he joined the RAMC, And I met him in Italy some 3 years later, you see. But he it was just more than he could afford to stay in the FAU. I think his wife worked for a while, but they just find it impossible to carry on.
Yes, what was the financial situation?
Well, when I first joined, there was nothing. You had to rely on anything that your family could give you. And then it was in the camp I was in that they decided that this couldn't carry on. And so those who were not... some fellows were still getting the wages paid, you see. And some had incomes of various sorts. I think it was about the third week I was there that they decided that they would pay us all, anybody who hadn't got anything coming in who couldn't afford, and I got 8 shillings a week. I think the most I ever remember getting was after this would, the 8 shillings after 5 years had gone up to about 25 shillings a week. But we had civilian clothing allowance to start with until we actually went abroad, went to a unit of any army unit or service or overseas. We had civilian clothing allowance, and we had all the food, of course, so there was no problem there. Everybody coped. I think it was a good thing, actually, to make you realise that you could cope on 8 shillings a week.
But married men with children had no sort of special consideration?
They couldn't. Later on they did. They found, I think, after some time that funds were coming in better, you know, as they got known. And then, we were attached to various things that where we were getting pay, like working for the LCC in London in rest centres or air aid shelters and things like that, you see, and they were paying so much to the unit for that. Some of the hospital work was paid for by the hospitals, and so I think then they began to build up funds so they could make allowances to two married men, you see, but there were very few married men ever joined. At least I knew very few. Most of them were single.
This initial training at the camp, was that comprehensive?
It was quite good, really. It was initially first aid and home nursing and a great effort to get you fit. You know, we did a lot of gymnastics and runs, and the aim was to get us out of our sluggardly civilian life. I suppose largely like the army ever did with its people. You know, the very first thing they did was try to get them fit to do what they were going to do. But after that, there was in the early days there was a dearth of jobs, very, very little. They'd been to Finland and that had fallen through. They were hoping to get work in Europe, of course, and then Dunkirk came and so that fell through. And so they were desperate as to what to do with us. So from the camp, which I was there, I think it was 8 weeks, I'm pretty sure it was 8 weeks, I went down to London and worked in Hackney LCC Hospital, which was very good, really, because you were dealing with... I'd never been in a hospital, never mind worked in one. I mean, I'd never even visited anybody in a hospital, so it was quite a new life to me. But the numbers, you got used to treating people who'd been operated on. You got used to the sort of hospital discipline of... which was a bit stupid, you know, in the old days, where every bed had to have its casters turned in one direction and sort of and the sister checked it all off. But it was all part of hospital life. And I worked there for quite a while. And then the bombing started. And then we went down. I went down to Hothfield in Kent to a workhouse which was being used as a hospital, and they had decided that to evacuate. They thought an invasion was going to take place, and they decided to evacuate this hospital. So we went to help them evacuate it and load the patients onto a hospital train at Maidstone, I think it was, and we were down there for a while. There was very little doing. We spent most of our time doing patrols at night in case of bombs being, fire bombs being dropped. And then from there, suddenly it was almost remarkable. One night, there was terrific noise down the road, and no end of tanks and guns came up. They'd obviously decided the invasion was not going to take place, and so they brought them back from the coast. And so we then, Battle of Britain was taking place. I remember we had all sorts of interesting jobs, like rescuing a Spitfire pilot from his plane, which had crashed in the field nearby. So he wasn't injured, but the plane was upside down and he couldn't get out of it, you see, so we had to get him out of that. And then we brought in a German pilot who'd been killed, and I always remember that. There was a tough, very tough sister in the hospital, and she was in tears. She'd rather been anti-FAU as well there. I mean, but to see this chap dead really did upset her. It really did move her. Then we went back to London and worked in rest centres, because London was being, the bombing was at its worst then. Worked in rest centres for a long time, and then I volunteered for China and was rejected because I didn't have a concern for China. And
was that a sort of criterion for getting into the China convoy?
It was the only time that people were going to the Middle East, and nobody ever going out to Egypt, the way you see, to work with the RNC, and nobody ever said that you must have a concern for Egypt or a concern for working in with the army, you see. There was never any mention of that. And then when China came up, this great thing about you must have a concern for the country. And so I was turned down on that. I couldn't positively pretend I had a concern. I would have loved to go to China. I would have found it interesting. And then Ethiopia came up. And like so many of these things, it took ages to, once they'd agreed to send a party out to anywhere, it took months before they could get a boat or a passage out. And this worked well with Ethiopia, really, because none of us, I don't think any of us knew anything about tropical medicine. And so we, when we were accepted for Ethiopia, we were initially sent to various hospitals. I worked in a hospital in Three Counties Hospital in Bedfordshire, that was at Arlesey, and I worked in the operating theatre there as a theatre porter. But that was a great life, that was, because you could see operations taking place, you could see the routine, and this prepared you really for the possibilities in when you got to Ethiopia. I also went to a dental hospital, here was I was a dental technician before I joined the FAU, and I was allowed to give anaesthetics and allowed to take the odd tooth out, which really surprised me. But I'd never seen anything quite so Dickensian as this hospital was. I don't know whether I'm babbling on about this, but it was rather amusing, really, because when I first went there, I went, they said, it was attached to the West Middlesex Hospital, and There was a dental surgeon in Harley Street who was a Quaker. That's how they got me there, you see. And so I went on this morning, and there was a queue of people sitting outside a door, each with a bowl in their hand, just an aluminium bowl sitting there. And they had the card with their information on it, and they were called in each time. They brought the bowl in. The idea of the bowl in was after it had the tooth out, it was something to spit into afterwards. But I couldn't believe this sort of... It just looked like a Dickensian scene of this queue of perhaps about six or seven people sitting there with this bowl. And but that was interesting. You know, you felt... you were being accepted as a reasonably intelligent, responsible person. You were allowed to give the anaesthetics, and I think I only took one tooth out, but I found it, you know, quite exciting, quite thrilling. Then I went. We did some medicine at Guy's Hospital. We went to the dispensary there, and we were making up medicine, did they, you know, for the wards, various wards. That was good. That was, you know, gave you an idea of future life. And then we all went to the missionary college, Livingston College in East London, and there we had a doctor, can't remember his name now, but he took us for tropical medicine, went through the, we were there 6 weeks or so, I think, and we also had an Ethiopian from the embassy struggling to teach us Amharic, or the basics of Amharic anyway. And then eventually we went out in groups of 10 to Ethiopia. I went in the second group, and that was quite good. We went on a boat with a number of Rhodesian army people. I think they must have been come up for training in England, and they were going back to Rhodesia, which seemed rather odd. I thought they were going out to the Middle East, but they went back to Rhodesia, and there were about six or seven of them, and 10 of us, and one or two other people on this boat. It was quite a small Dutch boat, and there was no antagonism with those chaps either. They were very friendly, actually. They quite an amusing lot, but they were really quite friendly to us. And went to Cape Town, then up to Aden, and then across from Aden into Ethiopia. This is where we met these Italian British coach, well, I don't know what that's for, they were Italian coaches which had been left, but they were being driven out by British Army personnel with Italian women and children in them, and they were being evacuated back to Italy. I presume they were being taken to Aden eventually, going to Berbera and then across to Aden, and then by ship to Italy. They would have gone through the Panama Canal, which seemed unbelievably humane sort of way of treating people. The men were all, the civilians were all sent down to, well, and the Italian army were all sent down to Kenya, to camps in Kenya, except where somebody had a bit of influence. We had I went to Desi. I went to Addis Ababa to start with, then I went up to Desi, and there was a town major who had been a political officer of some kind in Kenya, and He had got things very well planned for himself because he at the hospital, he used the hospital as his base. We had an Italian chef who was wonderful. We had an Italian gardener and we had an Italian mechanic. They should have all been in Kenya, but they'd retained them there for comfort for the local people.
When you went to Ethiopia, did you have special kit and sort of your medical bag? And
we had, we did, there was plenty of equipment there, because when the Italians had quite a medical service in Ethiopia, which had collapsed completely, of course, and we just had a small folder with a syringe, Spencer Wells forceps, and very, very few things, that was all. But when we got there, there's loads of stuff. Some of it had been looted, but it had been collected back. They'd gone round the Ethiopian huts and brought it back into the hospitals, you see, because there were hospitals all over the country. There were, you know, very few towns of any size didn't have a hospital of some size, really.
And would this have been, they would have been built by the Italians?
Built by the Italians out in the country. Some of them in the larger towns were ex-missionary hospitals. The Swedes had done a lot in Ethiopia before the war, and they had, I'm not sure, but I would guess they had three or four quite substantial hospitals there. And I think one or two of them are now back under Swedish control there.
Had the Italians done anything else for the country, from what you could see?
Oh, very wonderful roads, yes. Mm. The thing that really surprised me was when you consider what had happened when the Italians had really, you know, had attacked, how brutal they'd been. And yet how well the Italians got on with the natives. Wherever we met, like in this Plindesi, there were these three. I think there may have been one or two other Italians around there who shouldn't have been, but they all got on very well with the natives. Mind you, they looked upon the natives rather better than the English did, in that they weren't superior. They didn't try to be superior to them. And a number of them married natives, anyway, married Ethiopians.
Yet you felt there was a lot of brutality.
When they first went in, they were dreadful, yes. And the stories we were told of how the first aim was to eliminate all the authority, you know, every chief in every village was. We gather from the Ethiopians that they were dealt with, they were shot. You know, they just, once they'd broken down authority, then they felt they could rule. Then you see, they could, there's no way of being an uprising. They must, by what we're told, have been quite brutal. And yet, over the years, they'd done, I suppose they'd done a lot for the country. And as far as medical service was concerned, they'd never, before the Italians went in, they can't have had anything of any consequence. I know that there was a British Red Cross hospital in Addis, and then there were these Swedish hospitals. But I went down to Ergelum in the south, and that was a very small town, and they had a hospital there which had, I think must have had 15 beds in it, and an outpatient department, and that was obviously never there before the Italians went, you see.
Would it have been for the population or for the Italian
immigrants? I think it was largely for the native population. There weren't many, I don't think there were many Italians in the south there.
Well, what were the population like? You know, can you remember your first impressions of the place and the Ethiopian people? You said, first of all, you went to Addis, is that right?
Addis was, yes. And the thing that, the impression you got was how scruffy it was, really. You know, it was a very, very little sanitation even in Addis. A lot of quite big modern European buildings there. You know, the government offices were comparable with any you'd find in Europe. The hotel was we stayed in the hotel for a while until we found somewhere to live. The hotel was quite good. It was a bit basic, but it was quite good, really. The food was quite reasonable. The people, generally speaking, were very grateful for any help they could get. They were desperately in need of medical services. I think it was the Foreign Office or RCFA used to go. I think that's one of the best things the Foreign Office ever did, really, because it was really desperate. There was very little medical work being done. I went to a place called Deborah Burhan, where there was one Ethiopian doctor who, I don't know how well qualified he was, but he'd been in Russia and worked in a hospital in Russia. And again, the Russians had quite a reasonable amount of influence there. I don't know to what extent, but you heard quite a bit about Russians working in Ethiopia before the war, that was. But this chap was reasonably well trained. He knew quite a lot about medicine, and he was great help to us, actually. He was very elderly, but at least he was really the only. There were dressers that the Italians had trained, but they didn't have a great deal of knowledge. They could handle a ward like a third-rate nurse or something like that. You see, they weren't very. They were not at all sterile conscious, things, if they dropped a thing on the floor, you picked it up and used it, you see.
What would the level of literacy have been, in the population? Would they have received education, the bulk of the people?
Not too much. In Addis, they did have they had schools. Some of our fellows taught in schools in Addis, and they were teaching up to almost like a secondary level. But in the country generally, there was not a lot of literacy. The churches, Coptic church used to vaguely teach, but they seem to be teaching rather much as one gathers that the the Arabs teach like their Quran to their children, and I think it was rather sort of repetitive religious teaching that the Coptic Church was doing. They were supposed to be schools, but I don't think they taught them very much. I think there's a general lack of education.
And were there many sort of diseases endemic?
Oh, yes.
In
the malaria was absolutely rampant everywhere, you know, and I think there was a small amount of typhus. We found an epidemic of meningitis, and that was quite bad. Actually, we were asked. I was in Desi at the time. We were asked to go out and try and trace the what this was, what this epidemic was.